the 9th episode of our podcast series, in which hot topics, including new initiatives and alternative viewpoints on patient engagement within the life sciences sector, will be covered. Although patient engagement is more and more common nowadays, it's absolutely crucial that it's also meaningful and sustainable. With this podcast series, we would like to contribute to achieving that goal. My name is Roger Lechtenberg, and I'm a senior partner and co-owner of AdMedicum. And today I'm sitting with Trish Bartley, who taught mindfulness to many people, I would say, over the world with cancer since 2001. And she authored many books about it and, yeah, could be seen as a true authority in the space of mindfulness and cancer in Europe and actually beyond. So welcome, Trish, to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Roger. It's very kind. Yes.
And do you think you are a true authority in mindfulness in cancer, or are you a bit more?
I don't know. I'm never sure when I'm described like that. I mean, I guess in terms of, yeah, I mean, in some ways, but that's not of particular interest to me. I'm interested in what this might offer, I suppose. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know if you've ever heard of it, Roger. There's a nice quote that says, something like, in the expert's mind, there are few possibilities, and in the beginner's, there are many. It's quite nice. I quite like that. So I think beginner's mind is quite a good way to start. Yeah.
No, yeah. But I think being a bit humble and modest in life is not a bad thing in the first place, isn't it?
Well, there aren't that many that are there.
That's true. So maybe to get started, before we go a little bit more into the details of what you're doing and what drives you, yeah, well, maybe start off with what drove you into this field of mindfulness in the first place, and then more specifically towards cancer. What were the things that make you do this and really develop things in that field?
Well, as I think it often happens, I mean, some of it was just circumstance and happen chance, if you know that, you know, just like I've long been interested in meditation. I've long been interested in sort of finding ways to sort of manage well-being and feel a little bit more steady in myself, I suppose, you know, the different sort of things that happen in life, you know, mm-hmm. losing people, relationships, you know, and so on. And so I was already meditating, but then I became aware of some research that was happening around mindfulness and depression, actually.
Okay.
And I was involved in the early days, very early days in the UK, with people like Mark Williams and John Teasdale. So I was incredibly fortunate, really, and that's the happen chance. I was in the right place at that time. Well, I'm not a mental health practitioner, and I'm not a psychologist. So when I came across mindfulness in this way, I was really interested in taking it further, really interested in perhaps teaching it. Mm-hmm. I'd done a lot of work with groups, and my background was as a community worker.
Okay.
And at the time I was having treatment for cancer myself. So the kind of things came together, and really Mark Williams opened some doors for me in the hospital where I had my own treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And I started teaching mindfulness to people with cancer after their treatment. We can talk more about that. In 2001, so quite a long time ago, 2000 actually, 2001.
Right.
And so what happened is I kind of used the depression program that they'd started, and then started tweaking it over many years, really, with the help of John Teasdale, who was one of the founders of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So that's the long story, yeah.
And so you're intriguing me on the depression thing, of course. So mindfulness, yeah. You know, depression, that is something that is connected in some ways, or is long-term already connected. But so you say we were tweaking the program. I know there's many tweaks probably, so it's we don't go all through all the tweaks, of course, but
no, of course not.
But can you maybe digest like some kind of a red line through that? What are the subtle differences that are, if you would group that or summarize that in a few sentences?
Sure. I think there's a big difference between the sorts of needs that people who've had treatment and a diagnosis for cancer, what they bring, mm-hmm. and people with depression, what they bring. So the tweaks were very much to respond, I guess, to the uncertainty that's around for people who've had a diagnosis of cancer. The uncertainty, the anxiety. Yes, you're right. I mean, depression and low mood can come in there. Anxiety, I've certainly worked a lot with people who've got quite low mood. And it's often, you know, it's often fueled by anxiety and by this uncertainty. So I think that's something that people with cancer would recognize. So in terms of the intervention, intervention is very much sort of, again, sort of grounded, I suppose, in a reconnection with the body, which is tricky with mm-hmm. people with cancer because it's the body that's kind of let us down. But actually the body is the place that we can come back to and feel a bit more steady. The mind is very tricky to be steady with because the mind comes here, there, you know, wish I hadn't smoked in the past, or I wish I hadn't done this, or wish I'd done, you know, all those sorts of things. And the future of what on earth is going to happen, what if, you know. And so we learn in the intervention and just to come back to the body, come back to this moment. And that's really what mindfulness is. It's, you know, mindfulness in the modern day is kind of described as all sorts of things. And to be honest with you, mindfulness is really radical and interesting. It's not just colouring or taking a walk or taking a breath. It's got a lot more to it than that. So it's all of that. But then the other big thing that I think was very different from the mindfulness approach to the people with cancer than people with depression is these brief practices that we've really developed. Very, very brief practices that you can do in a waiting room, that you can do when you're having treatment, that you can do when you're waiting for results, you can do when you're having a row with your partner, when the kids are late for school. You know, most of mindfulness tends to be associated with much longer practices where people, you know, sit in a special way or they lie in a special and they close their eyes and they move the body, all that. We focus, I mean, we do have that, that's true. But
sure.
But we focus a lot on how to bring a very short landing practice, like, you know, this moment, okay, I'm sitting here, oh God, what's going to happen? What's my results? You know, this is tough. This is a tough situation, I can feel, you know, noticing that. And then actually, where are my feet? Okay, there's the floor. Something to just land into and just have a sort of anchor underneath that really supports.
So would that actually also be something then, going back to depression, not because I'm typically interested in depression at this moment, we are talking about cancer here, of course, mm-hmm. and mindfulness and cancer, but those brief sessions that you're describing that you develop for cancer patients, I guess that would also be beneficial for depression patients as well, to make it a low entry point maybe for people to get acquainted with mindfulness if they have never done that before.
Yes, I'm sure.
And then expand on that, or
I'm sure.
What are your viewpoints
yes.
on that?
In principle, yes. Everywhere, I mean, I don't work explicitly in the mental health field.
Sure.
I mean, not my specialism.
No.
Although obviously the people in the mental health field get cancer, so you know, you can't just say it's just like this or just like that. I think reconnecting with the body is very important. I think the other aspect of what we do with the cancer intervention, which I think is very special for any of us actually, mm-hmm. and that's reconnecting with what really matters to us. And of course, you know, if you've had a sort of existential, which I have personally twice, and the people who perhaps might be listening to this will have experienced that. But you know, a really shocking diagnosis or a, you know, something that really brings you up short. I mean, I remember when I was first diagnosed, you know, I was incredibly fit. I lived on a mountain. I could sort of half run up the mountain in 20 minutes. I was really fit. Yeah. I was meditating, you know, I was caring for my food, you know. So like, you know,
all of a sudden, everything is
all
gone.
All of a sudden, you know, yeah. just like I had this diagnosis, it was incredibly shocking. I mean, it really knocked me for six. And I think, you know, we come up short to kind of what is it that really matters to us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what in this life, you know, we've suddenly got this sort of wobble, this big wobble, you know, what is it that really matters? And I think what we come to is some things that are very straightforward, like our families, you know, our children, the way we connect with people, you know, nature.
You go back to the basics in a way, isn't it?
We go back to the basics. We go back to some things that are... Oh. There's quite a lot of research at the moment on awe, A-W-E, awe.
Okay.
Which is very interesting, and I'm very intrigued by it. And I think awe and mindfulness can go together very, very nicely.
What does awe stand for? Just out of curiosity.
I haven't got the definition sort of to mind very quickly, but it's very much where... You have perhaps a moment or a few moments. Perhaps you're looking at a tree or the sky, or perhaps you're climbing a mountain. You know, it might be, I've got some friends who are sailing across the Atlantic. You know, I'm sure they have dolphins visiting them. I mean, that must be a moment of real awe. So that's a moment.
Okay, I get it. Yeah.
It's a moment, but also the thing about awe is that it widens you into a bigger experience of perhaps life and meaning, the stars.
Different perspective on life at that moment.
A different perspective on life.
Where you are part of that life at that moment.
Yes. And where perhaps you've got a different view or, as you say, perspective. And I think that that's something that the mindfulness and cancer approach or intervention really offers, because we spend quite a lot of time looking at intention, you know, what is it that really matters to you that this practice might support? It's quite enough.
It's not the same for everyone, I guess, as well.
No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all.
Quite recently, you started, kind of a foundation around mindfulness and cancer. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Okay, yes, it's a bit grand to call it a foundation, Roger. It's quite early days. It'd be lovely if it was one day. It's a project for now. It's an international project. So our reasoning and our vision really was that people in Europe and the UK, and UK is Europe, let's say that quickly, but people in our kind of end of the world, you know, we can access mindfulness fairly easily. Not everybody, but, you know, if you can, you know, it's not that difficult to find. In fact, I'm told that the Netherlands has more mindfulness teachers per square kilometer than anywhere else in the world. So they,
really?
Yeah, apparently.
That's an interesting fact.
Yeah.
Not that important per se, but
no, okay. But interesting, yeah. But there are plenty of parts of the world where it's very difficult to access mindfulness. And there also... Generally, I don't know if your listeners would agree with this, but I think generally the support for people with cancer who've gone through a diagnosis and treatment is pretty patchy. I mean, in some places it's probably very good, and in many places it's pretty poor, to be honest. And that's true in the north of the world as it is anywhere else. You know, it's very patchy.
I think that's a big problem in general, especially with something so extremely intervening in your normal life as a cancer diagnosis and the treatment phases and stuff.
Absolutely.
I think it's something we see also as at Medicum, you know, when we're working in the field of cancer, but also many other fields that the intentions are probably good to do all kinds of things, but it's very much patchwork and definitely many ways to improve this and make it more coherent, I would say.
Sure, definitely. So you can imagine in places like Africa, there's absolutely almost none at all. Local people in Africa, you know, struggle to actually even get to treatment, let alone get any psychological or emotional support after the end of treatment, which is when you need it most, really. So we had this idea. I've got strong connections with Africa, and particularly South Africa. I've worked there quite a bit. So that was my hope, that perhaps we could reach parts of the world where there are some sort of low income countries, and maybe, you know, but also reach, you know, other places in Europe as well. So, you know, people wherever they are, but people particularly who haven't had much access to mindfulness around cancer particularly. So we've recorded, I think, something like 100 videos, little mini videos, about 3 minute, you know, 3-4 minute videos. Very, again, accessibility is the watchword. So we've done that. We've loaded them onto a learning platform. I'm still learning how to use the platform. my Dutch partner is much better at it than I am. We've basically offered it in a way that's very accessible. So right. We've got people coming in from rural Kenya, not many, but some, you know, who can access things for free.
If you only have one, that is already a win-win, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Here's the website address. I will also put it in the description of the podcast, of course.
That'd be great. That would be fantastic. Thanks, Roger. Yeah. So it's very simple. It's www.mindfulnessandcancer. That's all one word. mindfulnessandcancer.com.
Okay, great.
Very, very simple. Yeah. And when people go onto the website, they'll see there are two parts to it. So either they go to the area that's for people with cancer themselves, and there's a section there of free instant access practices that you can access straight away. Do sign up to the mailing list, and then you'll hear from me now and again. Or if you want a bit more, you can pay for, or if you can't afford, you can get those for free or for what you can afford. Okay. So that's really what we're looking at. And then
really nice.
On the other side, yes, it's great as long as we can keep it going. As long as
of course, you know, these kind of things do cost money and time.
We're not giving the time doesn't come into it. We're doing it pro bono very much, but the learning platform costs money, you know, the website.
Of course.
But no, it's very exciting, actually. I'm very thrilled with it. The quality of the videos are good. And it's very much based, well, let me show you, it's based on this book. So it's called Mindfulness, A Kindly Approach to Being with Cancer. This is the second book I've written about mindfulness and cancer. And this one is very much dedicated to people with cancer themselves. Now, the little mini videos are not, they're not the reading of this book. They're not kind of some kind of audio version of the book at all. They're much more immediate and spontaneous. But it's loosely based on the material in that book, Mindfulness, A Kindly Approach to Being with Cancer. So it would be a good companion to go with the website.
Exactly. So if you are interested into this topic and you have a certain need as a cancer patient, or you feel that you would love to get better acquainted with all this, the videos is a good starting point, but then probably you would dive into this book as well. And
If you like to read books, I think
exactly, that's also a thing, right?
Yeah,
everybody likes to read books. Yeah,
there's an audio version of it that I've recorded, so that's also possible.
Cool.
But yes, it's got lots of stories. I think that's what appeals to people a lot. So there's a bit of learning, there's a bit of explaining. There are some recordings and things, but there's also what the book offers that the videos don't offer, is lots of stories about people I've taught. And how they found things, you know, what their experience was, which I think is quite helpful.
Can you share maybe one or two short examples, without going into the details that are not appropriate, of course, but case examples where something happened and or you people gave back some feedback to you, what it did to them while going through this? Can you share a little bit or elaborate a little bit on that?
Okay. So, I mean, I've got a lot of examples, so I'm just...
I can
feel in my mind, I'm kind of going, shall I talk about that one or that one? A good example might be a man who came to the classes, who came along with his partner. His partner was keen, and he was extremely skeptical. I mean, he really, you know, when the more he heard about the classes, you could see him thinking, this really isn't something that I ever thought I'd do. But actually, he got a lot out of it. He really got a lot out of it. He was somebody who had quite low mood generally. I don't think he would be diagnosed with depression, but he didn't find life very easy. I think he was a bit of a, I don't know if you know Winnie the Pooh, he was a bit of an Eeyore, you know, he tended to see the, it might not work out, you know. Lovely, lovely man, but not an optimist at all. And he was very interesting because he really got it. He was quite a bright guy. He really got it. And he actually became very enthusiastic about practice.
Nice.
And it was helpful because he had a horrible diagnosis. He wrote a beautiful poem, which I think I might share with you, and I might read it to you, because I think perhaps it might demonstrate better than anything. The people I work with over the 8-week course often are asked to write a very short poem about their experience on the course. So this was his poem, which was absolutely lovely. It's called Buffalo. Still they come, my thoughts, trampling like a herd of buffalo through the green prairie of my mind, leaving their black footprints in the smooth pasture. But I am mountain man. They do not scare me now. And I watch them moving by with no more than passing interest.
Whoa, that's a lovely...
Isn't it beautiful?
...poem that says everything in a nice way, actually.
He's never written a poem before.
Well, that's even more remarkable, because this one is not bad at all, actually. It's really has a lot of subtlety in it. And
it's got some beautiful metaphors of buffaloes, which are loud and you know, they overwhelm. I can imagine if you were standing on the prairie with the buffaloes running past, you'd be...
Yeah, it's not a very pleasant experience, I guess.
And I'm mountain man. You were talking earlier about a perspective and just a different... And I think that's what mindfulness offered him and can offer a lot of people. So another one I'd like to share with you that I think is also very precious, actually. Woman that I worked with who didn't come on a course. She was pretty poorly. I worked with her for the last, 10 weeks of her life, probably over Skype. It was then. It was before Zoom was really doing its thing. A beautiful woman, and she'd been ill for a very, very long time, you know, so she'd never come across mindfulness until, as I say, 10 weeks before she died. So we worked together and we didn't do a course. We just did whatever was in front of her, really. And so I taught her some very basic practices, and she became also very keen. And the thing that I always remember about her is that she had a tree in her garden that she absolutely loved. It had spready branches, you know, it had sort of like a bit like, I don't think it was an umbrella tree, but it was a bit like that. And she had very happy memories of sitting under this tree, putting a chair under this tree. And I think there was a way in which the tree kind of held her. Sure. And I think nature can do that for us. We can find special places in nature that somehow incorporate some sort of connection that's really actually very, very helpful. Anyway, the tree was the connection for her. And we talked a lot about it, and she described this tree, and it just sounded beautiful. And it seemed to me that this tree was really holding her. Mm-hmm. And what was really lovely is she could see the tree out the bathroom window. So she would stand or sit, I don't know, you know, how perhaps lean, and see this tree and get this sense of connection and holding. And she did extraordinarily well. She really did beautifully, and she died very peacefully. And she practiced up until the day before she died, which is pretty extraordinary, really.
I think it's very difficult, you know, if you're relatively healthy or you didn't experience anything close to this, to really imagine how this would be. But I can imagine from the outside to look at it, and I can only be happy to hear that somebody finds the peace or the rest to live their last weeks of their life in a certain way. And
I mean, it wasn't all easy, but she obviously
connected,
and you know, I don't say that mindfulness made a peaceful end for her, but I think it certainly helped. So those are two examples. There are lots of others, really, but I think this business of connecting with what matters to us is really important, and kind of really noticing and spending choiceful time with you know, what has meaning and what's really supportive is very, very important.
So Trish, am I too blunt to ask you, or too direct to ask you to maybe do a little of those practice sessions?
Yeah, of course.
For the audience, whoever wants to listen and go through this and get a very first impression on how this goes.
Let's do that. I imagine most people listening to this will be sitting down. So I'm just going to speak to you directly and just invite you to, with your eyes open, you don't need to do anything special, just put your attention down into the soles of your feet and just see what you find there, perhaps noticing in the soles of your feet a sense of points of contact, perhaps with the carpet, maybe with your shoes. Maybe a sense of the weight of the body. You know, there's a way the feet hold the weight of the body, and then the floor holds the feet. So that sense of weight going down. That sense of the floor or the ground itself sort of holding us, just really supporting us, always there. So feet on the floor, that's the name of this practice, feet on the floor. We can do this anytime, any place. We can do it walking. We can do it sitting. We can do it standing. And, you know, if you're in bed and you wake in the night, which we often do, you know, it's a very familiar experience to me, then we can just lie on our side or on our back and just be aware of the body on the bed. So again, points of contact, sense of the body being held. And then carry on. And we don't need to do this for very long. I mean, you know, eventually, I mean, my challenge is to all of you to see, you know, if you do this a few times a day, you know, maybe a couple of times a day, decide you're going to do it when the kettle boils, or you're going to do it when you open a door, or I don't know. When do I do it? I do it walking up the stairs, just a few steps. I might do it when I wash my hands, which we do plenty of times, don't we? You know, just have a few times where you actually think, I'm going to do a feet on the floor then. And then just do it for a few seconds or for, just a short time. And after a couple of weeks, if you've managed to do that regularly, you know, like two or three times a day, when you remember, it's quite difficult to remember, but when you remember, you'll find it's there for you. And then when you need it, when a thing's a bit more tricky, you can actually just remember, oh, what was it that woman said? Oh yeah, feet on the floor. Oh, there they are, feet on the floor. I can come back, feet on the floor. So that's what we would call a first aid practice that I would, anybody I work with, that would be the first practice that I would teach them.
Yeah. Nice insight in what you do actually on a day-to-day basis on these kind of things. And that's, I think, incredibly helpful. Maybe at the last part of this podcast, I think it's extremely informative and inspirational, I would say. But do you have plans for the future? What are your personal dreams to move forward?
I do. I mean, it's the project that we spoke about before, because there's one side of the project for people with who've had a diagnosis of cancer. The other side of the project is called the Facilitator Training Program.
Okay.
And it would be lovely to, you know, for the project to move to become a foundation. That would be amazing. to have some more partners like AdMedicum, people who, you know, who are more commercial, who are prepared to help us out a bit. It would be lovely to, you know, to reach deep into places like India. I mean, India is doing quite well financially, but actually, you know, mindfulness, funny enough, actually almost started in India, you know.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's got a long way to go in terms of this more secular, you know, everyday approach. Reaching deep into Africa, you know, training local people to share like feet on the floor with others. That would be, and we're beginning to do that. So it's not impossible. Right. Yeah.
No, but nothing is impossible, I would say, as long as you strive towards it. And maybe you never reach that point completely.
Well, no, of course. But
that's,
maybe
that's how life is, right? And that's how you need to motivate yourself and motivate others in that process.
I think sort of teaching others so that it carries on, you know, with some similar vision and approaches would be great, but more to the point, let's have our vision that this podcast itself is of some use to people.
I hope so.
I hope so.
Truly hope so.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And anything else that you would love to share with the audience at this moment, Trish? Or did we cover most of the points?
I think we've covered most of it, really. I think, you know, mindfulness tends to be seen as something that might help us manage difficulty, and it does. I mean, I know that on a personal level, you know, every day actually. Mm-hmm. But I think that what this approach and other approaches as well, but we're talking about mindfulness and cancer, what it really emphasizes is how to spend time with things that uplift us, things that we enjoy, how to make choices on an everyday basis of noticing the tiny, the smiles, Now I've got a lovely dog here. I'm about to go and walk her. You know, the kind of the little things, you know, it's autumn, that the autumn leaves, you know, all those things which sound a bit flaky, haha.
Flaky. I appreciate life in its subtleties and everything.
And the very tiny things, yeah. You know, the first sip of tea when you're cold, feeling that mug of tea that warms your hands. Yeah. Very, very, just slowing down enough to really enjoy the small stuff. And I think that can be life changing. I think that can be transformative, actually.
Trish, it was remarkable to have you here and have this conversation with you. I have to say, I truly enjoyed talking to you today and what you've shared. And I hope it is indeed something that get people thinking a little bit, whether they are cancer patients or people working in that space, can also be pharma companies or doctors listening to this and thinking about the potential value that this brings. I think that is all win-win-win situations, I would say.
Well, thank you, Roger, for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And it's a chance for me to share news about the project and the work that we're doing with a new network. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Finally, I would like to also thank our listeners. I hope this 9th episode was informative and inspirational. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform and stay tuned for the next episode.